Who the fuck is... Who are either of these people? Aristor and Glorfindel?
Glorfindel is one of the elves.
Glorfindel... Aristor. I don't know who Aristor is, but Glorfindel is sort of... That's who they sort of merged Legolas and Glorfindel in the animated one.
I mean, there's a thing for Lord of the Rings movies, and there's a thing for all media types, but there's nothing that says, like, the Ralph Bakshi movie. Mm.
The user reviews on IMDb for this movie are generous.
Guys, I don't know. Gimli and Legolas is the second highest relationship.
That's so weird.
It's Frodo, Sam, and then it's Gimli, Legolas. I think it's got to be the movies that did it, the Peter Jackson movies.
Yes, but still.
I don't know. I remember Aragorn, Legolas being more of a thing.
Then it's Aragorn, Arwen.
Oh, that's boring.
Then Bilbo and Thorin.
What?
Because of the, again, because of Martin Freeman
and Richard Armitage.
And Richard Armitage, which, you know what? He can absolutely get some.
Wow, really, Lee?
Like, guys, Aragorn Legolas doesn't even, like, make... Oh, no, here it is. It is actually after born Bilbo and Thorin. It's Aragorn Legolas. And the lowest... The last one that gets, like, its own tag is Keeley and Toriel from the movies.
I mean, Keeley could get it.
Keeley was the best elf.
Who was that? The hot dwarf in Hobbit.
The hot dwarf, yeah. He was, like, super hot.
Yes, true. Who was the other young dwarf?
Feely.
That's right.
Feely and Feely.
It was
purely
a children's book.
Odie! Honestly, I thought it's a very successful book. I just wish the adaptation
No, I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying, like,
can
it's very clearly...
Can you stop bragging on the book?
Chris, fuck you and fuck your Hobbit.
No!
Thanks for the food, dude.
Thanks for the food, dude.
It's really good, dude.
The actual one was like, smash the plate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, because I was talking about the lyrics from the book. The plates. Because it's just like, it's like, that's what Bilbo Baggins hates.
Yeah. Guys, the listed goofs in IMDb are pretty funny.
They're good the whole movie. They meant to animate this, but just fucking left it in.
Well, I just love, it says character error. Saruman is called Saruman the White and Saruman of many colors, yet throughout the movie, he is dressed entirely in red.
It was red and yellow and scarlet and black.
All right, you know what I'm going to do? Can I search within a fandom? Search within results. I want to search cafe. Legolas gets a part-time job during his time at university.
Oh my god, please tell me he's a barista.
I searched cafe. So we're getting the barista AUs.
Yes! Why are we so popular, by the way?
I don't know! I mean, I don't know, it's right
part
in
part 1 of 23.
Oh, by the way, Brendan, I think this is something you picked up
it's
on.
It's a complete story.
It says, when Gandalf is revealed to be alive again, he jumps up onto a rock. His cloak becomes wrapped around his staff and has to be disentangled. Clearly a mishap carried over from live-action footage.
Yeah. It just looks so goofy, though. It looks like it's going to be such a dramatic reveal. And he's like...
Why Did We Watch This? The podcast where three friends discuss a very troubled movie with a themed cocktail and then, you know, just try to figure out what worked, what didn't, and then how they might fix it at the end. I am Chris, the Prancing Pony Ravel.
I am one Lee to Roll Them All Delahanty.
I am Brendan of Many Colors Trishler.
We have a really special treat all the way from Austin, Texas. We have our very dear friend, who, if you would like to introduce yourself.
I am Faith Looks Foul Feels Fair Johnson.
Welcome, Faith!
Yay!
A very old friend to us all.
Like tiny hobbits.
Like tiny hobbits, we clap.
And we pause, we look at each other, and then clap a little bit more.
If you couldn't tell by our nicknames, we discussed the kind of disastrously animated movie Lord of the Rings from 1979, animated by Ralph Bakshi.
I think it was 78.
Yeah, oh, 78. I'm sorry. I thought it was 79. I, for one, am very excited to discuss this with Faith. She is a very old friend to the group of us, and it's really good to have her here with us tonight.
Oh, thanks. And I feel like calling this a disaster is generous, because that makes it sound way more exciting.
That's a really...
Train wrecks are fun to watch. Yeah.
Well, they're at least engaging, right?
Yeah, like... they hold your attention.
Okay, so we're going to get into that in just a second, but Brendan, would you like to tell us about the cocktail we had tonight?
Sure. So the drink we made was called Mead of Moria. It was 1.5 ounces of bourbon, 1.5 ounces of mulled mead, 1 ounce honey syrup, some lemon juice, and a lemon ring garnish as the Eye of Sauron.
I thought it was really delicious.
I did too.
Interestingly, the combo of the honey and the mead and the bourbon all kind of combined into this very, it almost tasted like Fireball, like the cinnamon whiskey that people can do like shooters of. And I really liked it. It was a nice sipper.
Yeah.
It was all right. I mean, that was not my type. It's not my favorite type of drink.
I know, you're not a whiskey girl.
From a Delahanty.
I'm not a, yeah, I'm not a bourbon person. That's right. And, get it. I'm not a bourbon person, and I'm not as into, like, heavy sweetie drinks, like, heavy sweet drinks, like, that was more, like, a richness to it, rather than being, like, sweet, like, there's that sugary, overly sugary sweetness, and this was more of, like, a too rich.
The thing I actually found appropriate about it is we're kind of, like, we have sometimes summer, but then sometimes late fall weather at the moment, so, like, having a heavy but almost like springy drink was sort of appropriate for.
Yeah, it was as confused as the weather outside.
Yeah.
And Faith, you put together a little virgin drink for yourself, right?
I did. It was called the Saaruman of Many Colors, and it was one part blood orange San Pellegrino, one part lemonade, and one part iced tea. It was fine. It was also, I don't know, the blood orange was kind of overpowering, but, you know, it was a rather unattractive shade of reddish brown, much like most of the scenes in this film.
Yeah.
So it was very appropriate. We also had, like, some really good treats tonight.
We had lavender lembas shortbread.
Which was, I loved it. I could have eaten that all the time.
I have to say, I mean, I love lavender things, but maybe because I'm not a fan of shortbread, I was, like, not really into the shortbread that much.
What did you like tonight?
Yeah. did you like the gummy rings of power?
I didn't have any. I think I missed out.
Oh, there's like
somebody right over there. I'll have one later. The macaron was all that. The lemon macaron was pretty good.
Yeah,
the macarons of many colors. we had a good variety of treats tonight. It was good, and we had sour gummy rings.
Of power.
Oh, is that what they were?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I get it now.
I get jokes.
We had a lovely spread, and it felt very special to share that with all of you. So before we get into doing a postmortem, Brendan, again, would you like to give us a lovely synopsis?
I would. So going back to our good old friend Wikipedia, early in the second age of Middle-earth, elven smiths forge 9 rings of power for mortal men, 7 for the dwarf lords, and 3 for the elf kings. Soon after, the Dark Lord Sauron learns to make the One Ring and uses it to attempt to conquer Middle-earth. Following the last alliance of elves and men's fall, the ring is seized by Prince Isildur, and after Isildur is killed by orcs, the ring lies at the bottom of the river Anduin for over 2,500 years. Over time, Sauron captures the 9 rings and transforms their owners into the Ringwraiths. The One Ring is discovered by Deagol, whose friend Smeagol kills him and takes the ring for himself. The ring twists his body and mind, and he becomes the creature Gollum. Hundreds of years later, Bilbo Baggins finds the ring in Gollum's cave and takes it back to the Shire. Decades later, during Bilbo's birthday celebration, the wizard Gandalf tells him to leave the ring for his relative Frodo. Bilbo reluctantly agrees and leaves the Shire. 17 years pass, during which Gandalf learns that evil forces have discovered that the ring is in the possession of a Baggins. Gandalf meets with Frodo to explain the ring's history and the danger it possesses, and Frodo leaves his home, taking the ring with him. He is accompanied by 3 hobbit friends, Pippin, Merry, and Sam. After a narrow escape from the ring race, the hobbits eventually come to Bree, from which Aragorn leads them to Rivendell. Frodo is stabbed atop Weathertop Mountain by the chief of the Ringwraiths and becomes sickened as the journey progresses. The Ringwraiths catch up with them shortly after, and they meet the elf Legolas, and at a standoff at the fort of Rivendell, the Ringwraiths are swept away by the river. At Rivendell, Frodo is healed by Elrond. He meets Gandalf again after the latter escapes Saruman, who plans to ally with Sauron but also wants the ring for himself. At a council, Bilbo, Gandalf, and the others debate the One Ring, and Frodo volunteers to go to Mordor, where the ring can be destroyed. Thereafter, Frodo sets off from Rivendell with 8 companions: Gandalf, Aragorn, Boromir, son of the Steward of Gondor, Legolas, Gimli, the dwarf, and Frodo's 3 hobbit companions. Their attempt to cross the Misty Mountains is foiled by heavy snow, and they are forced into Moria. There, they are attacked by orcs, and Gandalf falls into an abyss while battling a Balrog. The remaining fellowship continue through the elf haven Lothlorien, where they meet Queen Elf Galadriel. Boromir tries to take the ring from Frodo, and Frodo continues his quest alone, but Sam insists on accompanying him. Boromir is killed by orcs while trying to defend Merry and Pippin. They are captured by orcs who intend to take them to Isengard through Rohan. The hobbits escape and flee into Fangorn Forest, where they meet Treebeard. Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas track Merry and Pippin into the forest, where they are reunited with Gandalf, who was reborn after destroying the Balrog. The four then ride to Rohan's capital, Edoras, where Gandalf persuades King Theoden that his people are in danger. Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas then travel to Helm's Deep. Frodo and Sam discover Gollum stalking them in an attempt to reclaim the ring and capture him, but spare his life in return for guidance to Mount Doom. Gollum eventually begins plotting against them and wonders if she might help. At Helm's Deep, Theoden's forces resist the orcs sent by Saruman until Gandalf arrives with the absent riders of Rohan, destroying the orc army. Ta-da!
It's a very abrupt end.
And then it also ends, to be fair. Theatrically, apparently, it was a different voiceover, but on home video, it ends with, "And the forces of darkness were driven from the face of Middle-earth." Which they weren't! There's that fiery guy with the eye who's still out there, guys.
Well, he doesn't have an eye in this movie, does he?
Well, no, but no. Whenever Frodo is looking in the Mirror of Galadriel, which he helpfully introduces
as the Mirror of Galadriel. Oh, it sort of blinks in and out, right?
Yeah, it's a weird, like, kaleidoscope eye that he has.
Yeah, it's not like a devil eye like it is in the new movie.
It's just like an abstract circle.
It's also, like, so clear, then, that second voiceover is just added in because they're like, well, there was no second movie, so we need to make this final.
Apparently, it was, like, a little more vague. It said something along the lines of, like, and they'll come back in part two or something right. like that. And then it was like, ooh.
It did say at the beginning of it, and, like, and that's the first part of this tale of middle or whatever.
Yeah.
Which I thought, like, oh, okay. I guess, Ian.
How ambitious of them to think that.
That there was going to be another one.
Well, can we go into, real quick, before we go into any of this, we should cover, I think, a little bit real quick of the backstory of this movie and how it came to be.
Yeah.
So, initially, my understanding is the director, John Borman, who later did Excalibur, using some of the technology that was developed for this tentative live-action movie, and our favorite, Zardoz, was going to do an adaptation of Lord of the Rings that was all three of the books condensed into one screenplay.
Which is quite ambitious.
It is, and I read most of that screenplay, and it does, I will say, a pretty impressive job of condensing it into one movie. Like, it's not great, but it does a decent job.
Quick question. Does it meld characters together?
It cuts, it more just like cuts extraneous ones out a lot, which is what you have to do whenever you're condensing this into one fucking movie. There is an intermission, though, in this movie, tentatively.
Oh, really?
Which is very cute.
That's just a very, like, 70s style.
Yeah.
Thing.
I mean, it's
even before that.
Yeah, it's like a roadshow thing in the
60s. Yeah, it's a very, like,
I was
going
to say,
thing.
It's very 60s.
Yeah. But,
well, it's still a Bollywood standard.
Yes. So whenever the Bollywood adaptation of Lord of the Rings comes
thank
out.
Thank you from our Bollywood correspondent.
Sorry.
Signed off from
that.
India.
Well, I was going to say, if we had Chirons, Lise would be a senior Bollywood expert.
Yeah, which is not saying much.
That's interesting, though. And I would have been intrigued to know what visuals John Borman would bring.
I mean, like I said, he seemed to develop some stuff that he got to use later on. He used some of it in Zardoz. He used most of it in Excalibur. Yeah.
I've never seen all of Excalibur. I've only seen part of it.
It's aight.
Like, it's fine.
Excalibur?
Yeah.
I watched it when I was way too young, and my mom was like, this movie's fine for you to rent.
You want
to
see Helen Mirren naked, right, Lee?
Yeah.
There's a lot of sex in that movie.
Yeah, there is. Then, my understanding was that the studio did not go with his version, but bought it, and he got, like, $3 million for just writing it, basically. Mm-hmm. And Ralph Bakshi was like, no, I can do this. I can do this animated. And the studio was like, fine, you have two movies to do Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And so he tried to condense it into two movies, did the first half. The first half did make money. It was done, I think it was done for, like, $6 million and made 30 or something like that. And so it did make money, but the studio never did a second half.
Why didn't they do it then? If it made
probably
money?
Dealing
well,
with Bakshi.
I was
going to
say
it's
part of that. And my other guess is, so as we all know, the movie was rotoscoped entirely. So effectively, what they had to do was film a live action version of the movie, and then go back and either trace over it or use a solarizing technique to make it look kind of like animation.
Right.
My thought is also maybe just that is taking too much fucking time to do. It's just not
or
worth the
hassle.
Or did
they just look upon what they had wrought?
God, we want more of this out there.
Or honestly, I would not be surprised if either they were tired of dealing with Bakshi, like Faith said, or if Bakshi was like, I can't take studio meddling anymore, and just stomped out.
I mean, he wanted to do a second part. So
really?
My understanding is that it was not his choice to not do a second part.
Interesting.
I mean, he's just, that man is as stubborn as a mule, so he's just like, I said I was gonna do two parts, I'm gonna do two parts.
Yeah.
Stubborn as a mule, and yet does not seem to know what he really wanted to do.
No.
Because that's what came through for me when I was reading the Wikipedia history on this, is that he's like, well, I wanted to adapt the books pretty much as straightforwardly as possible, and then that's really not what you get.
Well, I think you get is you get a complete Cliff's Notes version.
Yes.
Of it. Like, you're hitting all the beats, but you're not getting any of the emotional connection you might have with the characters. You're not getting any emotional fallout. You're not feeling, like, the emotions you should be feeling.
We're getting into,
you don't feel the stakes of the story.
Yeah, well, we are getting into it, yeah.
I was going to say, so why don't we kind of just take a little bit of a step back and kind of just go back to the source material a little bit and just talk about Tolkien in general.
Talking about Tolkien.
I've got a soapbox to get up on.
I know. Well, so
let me get it for you.
I actually just
wanted... stand on the soapbox.
I just wanted to do a quick quiz with everyone here. Has everyone read the books, all three?
Yes.
In high school, but I don't remember them very well.
My parents read them to me in, like, third grade, and then I think I reread them in, like, middle or high school.
I was going to say, Faith, you come from a line of very proud Tolkien lovers.
Yes, I'm afraid my parents are going to, like, disown me if I say anything bad about anything.
Wait, do they know? Have they seen this movie?
Yes, my dad actually saw it in the theater in 1978, and he said there was a little kid in the theater with a cap gun, and, like, anytime, like, the orcs were on screen, like, the kid would run up, like, with the cap gun and start shooting at the orcs.
That sounds more amusing than anything that happens in the movie.
It really does.
Honestly, that would enhance the movie.
Yeah, I don't know that my mom has seen this version, or she's not seen all of it, but my mom kind of hates, like, bad animation.
Well, and does your father have fond memories?
Yeah, does he like the movie at all?
I don't think so.
Okay.
The thing I would honestly
want to know is I'd be more curious in hearing, like, what his thoughts were back in 1978 when he left the theater. Right. Was he like, oh, okay, like, this guy's figured it out? Or was he even then like, what the fuck is this shit?
That's something I battled with a lot, actually, where I was like, how much of this is me just living in a world where I have already seen the better version of this?
Well, yeah. I mean, you should probably, like, go to reviews, I guess, if there's any on file.
That's a good point.
That's true. There's a lot of inconsistencies with those reviews. I mean, not inconsistencies, but, like, there's a wide range of opinions.
Well, so...
I never got to talk about if I read the books or not.
Well, yes, I was...
do you want to talk about that, Lee?
Yeah,
you seem to really want to talk about
You're standing
that.
Up on this soapbox.
Yeah,
I'm standing up here. No,
it's beginning to
I'm
creep.
Not ready to get on the soapbox. I'll answer the question first, and then if you want to... But I read... My parents also... Well, they're big, like, fantasy people in general, at least my mom was. And I grew up in the house with a lot of, like, old fantasy books. But I did not... read. I guess here is the time to mention that from the age that I was, like, maybe 10 until, like, last year of high school, the only thing I knew about Lord of the Rings was a photo novel of this movie.
Would you like to describe what a photo novel is for those who may not know?
I didn't realize until, like, a week ago that a photo novel was, like, a series that was around when I was a kid. I thought that, like... they made this animated movie of Lord of the Rings that I had never seen and could never think of obtaining as a child. But because the movie had been made, they decided to, like, make a comic book out of it by taking, like, screenshots and just, like, putting, like, dialogue on the screenshots.
But, like, really weirdly formatted dialogue. Like,
I think you're the only person that's brought that up out of the four of us who have read it. So I don't know how weird it is versus you finding it weird.
It seems pretty... it's because it's, like, things in captions, and then there's occasionally, like, little, like, lines going to people's mouths when they're saying, like, bah, bah, bah,
that's
bah,
what
bah.
I'm saying. It was very strange to look at.
I mean,
that's
like a comic book.
But it felt like reading, like... someone's webcomic that they put together.
3-1.
You've seen it. You've looked at it for like 30 seconds today.
And then, well, that was my takeaway.
Yeah. That was what I got. No,
well,
but this
was also like in a comic book, things are like specifically formatted to fit around text.
Yeah.
Whereas this, you kind of have to like fit the animation cell.
That's
with,
true.
But I mean, it makes the movie look a lot better than it is.
Oh, yeah.
The images are like downsized and like they caught good frames that people weren't in like.
Well,
when there's no.
There's
motion.
A few where they were.
Well, there's
not
a few. Like derp frames, but you're not gonna like get them all.
Right? Yeah.
But like the people look like, oh, well, surely when this is in motion, everything's fine, right? Like it's not terrible.
Nope.
But so like literally, aside from like sort of cultural absorption of people around me, everything that I knew about like what the characters were like and like what how many there were was from this book. But I eventually did read Fellowship of the Rings because it was like on the summer reading list back when you still had them or something. And I read it over a summer, and I was like, it took me ages to get through, and I was like, this is the fucking most boring book I've ever read.
Yeah.
And I never bothered with any of them after that.
So that's sort of a common criticism, I feel, with these books, and that is one I also kind of also feel, is that Tolkien's writing style is bone dry. Drier than the driest Prosecco. Like, it's hard to... get a lot of juice
out
of it.
Well, he also crams so much in there because he, like, thought of, like, the whole mythology of the world.
Well,
and
Tolkien's a scholar and a linguist and a world builder first.
Yes.
And he is a writer and a storyteller second.
Yes.
For sure.
So it's like, it is extremely impressive, the intricacies of this world that he's built.
Yeah,
and I do want to honor that in how really kind of beautiful that is. But then it almost kind of set the template for what would become a problem, I think, later in fantasy novels, where it becomes so world-building obsessed.
Well, yeah, because a lot of people try to imp Tolkien.
Right.
And they're actually just not that good at the world-building part.
Right.
And
but then it gets so focused on world-building that they don't invest enough in the characters. But
yeah.
I actually think that's where Tolkien went right. A lot of the characters are
well
fleshed out.
He's the only one that can pull that off.
Right.
Yeah.
The thing, there was an article about this a while back, and it was like a writer talking about like tips for other fantasy writers and says like, guess what, guys? Like, you're not Tolkien. You have to spend a lot of time on like your story and your character and make people want to read about these people because your world is just not like, your world is only interesting to you.
Right.
And, like, I don't want to hear about like how the history of your 100-year-old kingdom and like...
And here's, actually, my read on that, too, was even if your world is interesting to other people, going in there with the assumption that it is going to end up tripping you up.
Yeah.
So it's the advice was to invest in character and story. And I think, in this case, the story is interesting, and the characters are interesting, and the world is really interesting, but Tolkien's style of presenting it is... it's tough to access.
I sort of think that Tolkien is like a bit like Shakespeare with how you have to adapt it, where you have to like bring some of your own interpretations to it to make it accessible.
Right.
The thing that I think I always found interesting about Tolkien is how so much... So you start with The Hobbit, right? And The Hobbit is basically a very, very long children's book because it's a very simple, straightforward plot. The characters
and there's like trolls and
right,
magic.
Yeah, and they there's basic stuff that kids love. Everyone has very simple motivations.
I was in love with that book when I was little.
Right, because you're a baby.
Right.
And
and I still am.
And you still are. I'm a little baby.
I'm a little baby.
But it's so weird to think, to look at that book and be like, this is like the starting point for a fucking mythology of the ages. Like, to look at this and be like, now he's going to come up with like 30 dead languages and an entire history of this world.
And you know what's weird is like, there's a dragon in The Hobbit, which like, as a standalone thing, you're like, sure, there's a dragon.
Yeah.
But then you're like, where are all the other dragons?
Right. No, it does raise... And then, like, how he, like, had to retroactively go back and explain the ring war, when originally it was like, it's a magic ring. It makes you invisible.
Yeah.
What about it?
Right.
And that, but then it's just like, okay, this is, like, the most important object in this entire world.
It's not just a goofy MacGuffin. It's, like, a thing.
Yeah.
It's almost Lucas-esque.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I think it's
a little more deftly handled than anything.
He handled it
completely.
But, like, it does come off like he didn't really know about it at the time.
Oh,
like,
yeah, no. It feels... And I mean, I'm sure this is like a fact and not my opinion that he just did not have that planned out at the time. And he was just like, I'm going to write a fun book called The Hobbit.
Which, by the way, not that there's anything wrong with that.
Oh, no, Chris, there is so much fucking wrong with that. And I'm going to tell you each and everything right now.
No, I think like that's what a good world builder does. Like
if
you're in a campaign, if you're like a DM, if you're a dungeon master today and you're like, oh, I wrote out this thing and I wasn't really thinking about it at the time. But then like you remember it in your head and you're like, oh, actually,
I can expand
this.
This
is the big bad boss of the entire campaign.
Right.
Like you are able to like work it into that, then like that's just like deftly improvising your story.
Yeah, it's clever. It's very clever.
Yeah.
Well, and I do again want to just honor the fact the world he created is extremely rich.
And I mean just like look at how many novels have been like done about like the history. Like there were like 12 fucking volumes that like he and his son had done.
I say that for it being rich and detailed, I'm not that interested in a lot of it. I think maybe that's because of it's very like it goes away from the sort of like proto fantasy fairy tale stuff and into this more like deity, like pantheon, like religion based one where it's like the Ishtar come from this planet and there are this many of them and then
I wonder if that was like C.S. Lewis's influence or something.
Then
hung out at Oxford all
the thing,
they wrote letters to each other a lot, didn't they?
But here's the thing, I respect Tolkien a lot for what he did to fantasy and like expanding it as a genre because it was still pretty young back then. But Tolkien was inspired by C.S. Lewis, who was inspired by George MacDonald. And George MacDonald is my jam.
I've never read George MacDonald.
He's a good author. I've talked about
you've
at length
him.
On this podcast.
Yeah.
Guys, get it. Read Fantast. The foreword is by C.S. Lewis. Actually, that might be by Neil Gaiman nowadays, but there was a foreword by C.S. Lewis at one time.
I'm sorry, can I say my real quick, one of my favorite things, when Hugo Dyson, he was a writer when he was reading Lord of the Rings, and like the feedback that I have, like a quote from him, was at one point he was reading it and he said out loud, oh, not another fucking elf. Which I think encapsulates a lot of like sort of Lee's feelings, perhaps, and my feelings to a certain point.
Well, and I was gonna say, like, I feel like sometimes Tolkien also just ends up letting his focus drift on smaller non-plot related characters or details that is sort of maddening to read because you feel like, I don't care about this. I want to get back to the main plot. So, I mean, like, the example I will hold up that I feel like a lot of people hold up at of that is Tom Bombadil.
Which but I love Tom Bombadil.
I hate Tom Bombadil.
Motherfuckers.
Tom Bombadil. I hated how much time you took up in the book. I hated how it gave
us nothing
for the story.
I just love the concept of Tom Bombadil.
Yeah.
I like that he could very well be God.
Pretty much is.
He seems to be, like, the most important person in the universe.
He's just fucking around in the woods.
Yeah.
Like, doing nothing.
Yeah.
Smoking his pipe, hanging with Goldberry.
At some point, I think Gandalf says something along the lines of, like, if they gave the ring to Tom Bombadil, it wouldn't be bad, but he'd probably misplace it because he doesn't care about it. It's like, I love that you, like, give him this evil option. He's like, oh, whatever. And just, like, goes off singing his dumb songs in the middle of the woods.
Well, I was going to say, which is sort of an amazing concept that, like, the most powerful being in this or in any universe is just so, like,
this old,
lackadaisical and carefree.
But my most vivid memory of reading Fellowship was, like, just reading a battle and being like, is stuff happening right now? It was the most, like, boring, like, just bland description of action I've ever seen.
Well, and everything is so... I mean, I will say, I think Tolkien has moments of poetry that really sing to me, but there's many parts of it which almost just read like a straight historical account. And it reminds me a lot in style of, if you've ever read any kind of like Chinese historical novels, there's one I picked up.
Have you ever read any Chinese historical novels?
Well, I know. Okay, so there's one I picked up because there was a very long-running series of video games based on it. The games are called Dynasty Warriors, but it's all based on this very elaborate novel called Romance of the Three Kingdoms. Mm-hmm. And I thought, like, okay, well, the Dynasty Warrior games are so ridiculous and over the top, maybe this book will be too. It's not. It's a very dry, like, and then this person did this thing. And then this other did this thing.
Dynasty Warrior, that metaphor is like, I appreciate Tolkien. I would appreciate the author of Romance of the Three Kingdoms for giving me Dynasty Warriors.
Yeah.
But, like, the original thing is not interesting enough to me. I appreciate that, like, it gave a world and inspired people to do, like, I don't know, more interesting things with that world. Like, and making it a little more fun and crazy.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, the style of the writing is very similar in that it's just so, like, just sort of almost like bullet points.
Procedural.
Of, like, yes, it's very procedural. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my general complaint.
I've been talking a lot in this segment, and it's been me dissing Tolkien, but, like, there are people like Tolkien, and I'm not going to hold, like, you know, I appreciate that, like, he did a lot, and he's actually, like, known to be a good writer, so I don't want this to be, like, a we all diss Tolkien section.
I don't mean to diss Tolkien at all. I think there is room in enjoying his work and enjoying him as a writer for critique.
Yeah.
And
That's any work.
Yeah. I have no problem. I don't care if I ever read Lord of the Rings again, but, like, if you read it every year and you get enjoyment out of that, then more power to you. It's not a bad book. I don't think you're bad for enjoying it.
No, and I don't think it's, like...
It's just not my jam.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I am always someone who, you know, wants a little extra juice in there. You guys should have seen the little motion I did.
Should we have...
You really shouldn't have. It's very sexual.
But there is one thing that while we were watching this movie that Faith brought up, that mm-hmm. she kind of said injects some of that more of the interest and what can kind of pull you into the story more, is the chemistry between characters.
Yeah.
Which we actually found to be entirely lacking from this adaptation.
Well, I was watching, I had a thought when there's that scene in Moria where Frodo gets hit by a spear in awkward slow-mo. and then he's, like, on the ground, and Aragorn runs over and is like, and he's, like, sort of attending to Frodo. Frodo says, like, I can stand. And Aragorn says, like, I thought you were dead. And I was like, I don't buy that there was, like, any worry in Aragorn's voice.
I just don't, the voice acting just isn't...
It's flat.
Very strong. Yeah. It's really flat. Like, it's, a lot of the characters sound the same. It feels like they probably weren't recording together at all, which is, I guess, common for voice acting.
It is fairly common.
But it's still just...
It felt very...
But you still know how to do a performance. Like, maybe they weren't voice actors, because, like...
Yeah.
I think voice actors know how to give a performance.
Well, but it felt very cold, and it also felt... The lines they were saying and the things they were saying at many times felt divorced from the expressions that were on the animated characters' faces.
Well, I think the problem you have there, though, is you have... with the entire movie being rotoscoped, you have people acting it out. And so these people are acting it out based on what?
Right.
People are acting out based on what they think is happening at the scene. Then you have a voice actor who will come and be like, oh, I think Aragorn would say this line like this.
Right.
And so you can have him flailing about and, like, shaking his hands, but he'd just be like, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is that...
the way that the movie is done leaves no room for actors to interpret a scene.
It feels ass backwards to do voice. I assume, I mean, I could be wrong, but I would almost assume that they did voiceover like after the fact.
I get that feeling as well.
Because it just feels like when normally you would record the voice and then you would like animate based off of this. Because you're going through the trouble of making an entire movie and then animating it on top of it, you must have had to start with people doing like the live action work first, and then you're having people do voiceover. It's not even like you had people on set lip syncing to what was being said.
Right.
Yeah, because all of like the live action stuff, was that all shot in Spain?
Yeah, it was all shot in Spain.
So it was like with Spanish actors probably.
I don't know if it was Spanish body doubles. But like, so it was not
the people who eventually did the voices.
So much problems for that.
Mm. Yeah. So I think part of the fact that this movie has no chemistry is just like, how could you have had any like organic chemistry or like authentic acting in the movie when it's like in this like slipshod piecemeal way?
Yeah.
Well, and as for people who have seen the Peter Jackson adaptations, which whatever criticisms you may have about it, did deliver really good character chemistry.
That was the one thing that made the movies more interesting than
But it's hard not to compare these two. Do you know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, but I think it's important to compare them because you can see like how the story becomes more compelling when like Sean Astin is like, oh, Mr. Frodo.
Yeah.
Like,
well, yeah.
As opposed to like a tiny grotesque man being like, oh, Mr. Frodo.
Yeah. And like when you have like Gimli and Legolas, like you have time. First of all, you have more time for them to
You can just spend time with characters.
Them, like, and have like, their arrow contests. Yeah. And like,
well, and it's when they did that live action adaptation with Peter Jackson, they took away a lot of the hurdles that I feel like they erected for themselves in this adaptation, which is they had actors there making choices which still translated into the final project.
Yeah.
And they were able to have this chemistry with each other that we could see and feel.
Yeah.
Whereas that was completely sanitized out in this adaptation when they animated over whatever was happening and recorded new
but
dialogue.
Even without that, I think there's some degree to the way that it was, the way the script was written. Because a lot of the dialogue and the events are just like verbatim. But the way that the script was written, it sort of takes out you get the sense that like people in the backseat Lord of the Rings are just like, just doing a job. I gotta go on this quest.
Through the motions.
Well, like, people in the Peter Jackson movie, like, have, like, formed a actual fellowship and are, like, bonding as people while they do this.
The screenplay reads like a best of Tolkien, where you're like, okay, this line is memorable, this scene is memorable.
Sort of like they, like,
let's
slip
flip
through,
all the, yeah, like, let's,
highlight
like, everything
it.
Else is cut, we'll keep this shit, and this is gonna be our movie. Yeah. But that obviously, like, eliminates any other hope of this possibly being a coherent movie.
Well, and it sort of decimates any possibility for any emotional resonance.
Yeah.
Kind of like the oh my god, is Frodo dead moment, that's so divorced from any emotional weight because we don't care by that point.
Yeah. I mean, when Gandalf is like falls into the pit with the Balrog, just sort of like, okay.
Well,
like,
yeah, well, and when in that scene where we think Frodo might be dead, I actually had a thought of like, well, if he is dead, then someone else can just pick up the ring and bring it to Mount Doom.
Well, I just had a random question, theoretically. What if Frodo did die, and what if they just carried his corpse?
Would they need to?
Does that work? No, but like if the ring was still on him, would somebody be compelled to pick the ring up?
Because Boromir is still tempted by the ring when like Frodo has it, so I think the ring still has like this sphere of influence all around
it. Well, they should scientifically like control, you know, like do some experiments. But, like, what's the radius? I'm just saying, guys. If I'd have been there, it would have been a lot fucking simpler.
I guess, you know, someone who was seeing this in 78 wouldn't have had these expectations of that kind of character chemistry necessarily.
I mean, would they, though?
I think I would.
I feel like I would have.
As a person.
If they read and loved movies about people.
That's true.
Yeah, that too. Frankly, I think it fails on a movie level because it's just not a very good movie. But I think also, like, face it, if I had read the books and I went to this movie being like, oh boy, Lord of the Rings, the movie, finally, I would still leave this being like, well, like, you're getting the sequences, I guess, but you're not getting anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And it is a lot of the mechanisms of the story without really any of the soul or compelling
notes. It's not even that like all the action looks cool.
Yeah.
Like it's just boring.
Oh my goodness, the action looks so telegraphed, and I just kept giggling at whenever someone like would strike another person with a sword, it always sounded like they're getting hit with like a PCP pipe. It would be like, oh, poof.
Yeah.
It sounded like they're punching each other with swords.
PVC pipe, Chris?
What did I say?
PCP is very different.
What a more fun movie it would have been if they were into the PCP pipe.
I mean, that would be the John Borman adaptation, probably.
Yeah.
That's actually true.
Yeah. No, it's just, if you had trimmed out every single moment in this movie of people just staring at each other from across a field or not chasing after each other, we could have trimmed, like, 30 to 45 minutes from this fucking thing. Hmm.
That's something that I thought was very strange. And, you know, let's transition from this into just kind of the issue of adapting three books into two movies. But I want to start on this point of, when I was watching this for the first time, I was so amazed at how I was like, okay, you have this task of adapting these three very long, intricate books into two movies, and you waste so much time on these, like, long, lingering establishing shots and these long shots of stare downs and these long sequences of a horse kind of galloping forward and then cantering back. Like, you could have cut all... There was so much room.
I think they were trying for something. I don't know. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel
Question mark? They
wouldn't have put it in there if thought it was, like, wasting time.
I wonder
if maybe Ralph Bakshi's just not a very good live-action director, and so maybe this is, like...
He was like, have the horse chase, and he's like, what do you mean, like, dance on
it? They stare at each other for a while, right? That's how a horse chase goes.
Because those scenes felt interminable.
Oh, they're horrible. They're so fucking dull.
Well, it was just like, it's... More than being dull, it's like, it's baffling. I was like, what is happening? There's a shot of the Black Rider and he's dancing sideways.
Yeah.
And it's Frodo's horse dancing sideways.
I think maybe the horse was like trying to go away, but then like the Black Rider was like, no, go.
So this is the thing.
Do you know what you do as a director? You don't put that in the fucking movie.
Yeah, no. There's a great many instances where it's clear that like, something got screwed up while they were shooting and they just like did not have money for another team.
Yeah, like when Aragorn
Aragorn trips, I think, over his scabbard at one point and they leave it in.
Yeah, that and like Gandalf and his robe.
Yeah, Gandalf gets tangled up in his robe.
Well, then he's twirling it around and you think it's gonna be this badass reveal, but then it just gets like hooked on his head and
he's like
But yeah, that was so baffling to me how obvious the cuts were. And I was like, if you wanted to really make this kind of a lean machine, you get rid of
one of the cuts where like they walked by the tentacle monster outside Moria, and then they're like reading a journal, and the journal is talking about like
the tentacle monster.
Yeah, there was a tentacle monster. It's like, well, we know that.
We didn't need that.
I love that the tentacle monster also closes the doors after them. Whenever they get inside, it just like slams the door shut and be like, and stay inside. They're like,
also,
that's the opposite of what you're trying to do, tentacle monster.
They took out the entire like Battle of Isengard, but they left an Ent.
Yeah.
Right.
Like just one Ent.
Well,
that was because picks up Merry and Pippin.
Right,
because
that would chronologically
like,
happen
just,
after that event.
They could have just like cut all of it.
Well, do you want to see people dressed as trees rotoscoped into like?
So that would have been, in, like, a sequel that was hypothetical at the time.
Well, yeah, I would, like, don't have an Ent if, like, you're not going to do anything.
Chekhov's Ent.
That shows up two-thirds through the movie.
Yeah.
Appears in one scene and never again.
Never again. And they kind of treat it with some amount of import, because it's sort of like a big entrance for him. No, it's not, actually. It's not,
be.
No.
Because that entrance was like, what's that?
It's
and
a
then,
goofy moment,
and then there's a cut.
And then they're just
in the hands
where
of the
they're like,
end.
The forest is nice. He's like, oh, I'm so glad you like the forest. And then the next shot is him, like, he looks like a fucking cartoon carrot or something.
It is like a very, like, 1920s style, anthropomorphic plan.
Like, without the whole Ent arc, what he is reduced to is, like,
a weird
chauffeur.
Yeah.
Like, he's just, like, there to carry them to one place.
Out of the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah,
out of the movie.
Well, okay, so one of the things that I read, and these are quotes from Ralph Bakshi that show up in the Wikipedia page over and over, is how he's like, I just wanted to take the text and put that into the movie. And he does that at many points, but I would say, like, a lot of my issues with, like, where you can cut doesn't have to do with a slavish devotion to the text. It has to do with long, pointless takes.
I think you could have done... It better. I think Peter Jackson did it better. But, like, I think you could have adapted the text purely and with a better cut. Like, I don't think it was just that he put useless stuff in.
I think that's what I'm saying. Like,
I think he also cut some of the wrong stuff
out. He made,
out.
Yeah, very questionable decisions in condensing it.
But, like, it's also... It's a hard ask, and I don't remember from your thing if it was, like, his decision or the studio's decision.
I think it was a studio mandate to
Yeah, because, like, To condense three things into two, it just doesn't, the math doesn't work out that way.
And the biggest problem, I think, for me is that when you're doing one and a half things in one, it leaves you at a terrible endpoint because you don't have anywhere, because, like, you feel at the point after Boromir's been shot and Sam and Frodo are going off in the boat, like, there is a moment of, like, natural conclusion at that point. Yes. Where you're like, okay, now it's over. But no, there's 30 minutes left where they have a battle.
Yeah.
And a very truncated one.
Yeah, very shitty battle.
Yeah. Well, also, I think the Two Towers is, like, distinctly split into, like, the, like, Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli part, and also, like, the Frodo and Sam part. Like, it's, like,
yeah.
a distinct, like, delineation, like, half and half of the book.
But they're also...
So really, you could put one in the first movie and one in the second, although you do kind of leave the question of, like, where did these characters go?
Yeah.
I think we can acknowledge Ralph Bakshi had a very tall order ahead of him, but I don't think that... He fucked up how he condensed it.
Yeah, no, he did fuck it up.
Completely.
Yeah.
It's boring.
The events
it's
that
stodgy.
Take place make no sense.
The pacing is
there are
very
so many,
weird.
If you did not, I can't imagine watching this movie with no context of what Lord of the Rings is. You would just be sitting there fucking like confused as to who the hell these people were,
what
was going on.
I didn't notice until tonight, but it's so weird that Grima Wormtongue shows up in Saruman's tower just to hand him his staff.
Yeah.
He shows up in his tower and then he shows up in a scene that I think was meant to be a flashback, but they don't set it up that way.
Which where Saruman's talking to the troops.
Yes.
I don't know if it is or isn't, to be honest.
Okay, well, if it's not, then we have a really weird
timeline. No, I think it's clearly like a teleportation thing where the Ringwraiths taught him how to teleport from one room
it
to the other.
It has to be.
Yeah.
Like, that has to, like, the only possible explanation is a wizard did it. You know what I mean?
Well, hey, there he is.
Well, I know, but, like, because it's literally in one scene, Grima's at his side while he's kind of, like, talking up. Well, Saruman, or Ahriman, is talking up his warriors, and then the very next scene, he's cowering next to Theoden.
Yeah.
Stroking his beard.
Fluffing his beard, rubbing his little face.
He's like, oh, you're my pet, yes!
Guys, can I also say something?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I'm going to, though. So, if you, in your movie, had a character named Saruman the White... I expect two things of him. One, he is white, and two, he's named Saruman.
Right.
And somehow this movie fucked up both of those things.
Wow, he is white? What a
race. I'm just saying. Everyone in this movie is white.
I don't know that they actually call him Saruman the White. I think they just call him Saruman of many colors.
He calls himself Saruman of many colors. I don't remember if Gandalf addresses him as Saruman the White.
He does at one point.
Maybe
I think
at the very beginning. Although
and then
he calls him Aruman the White.
And then there's
first,
also the one part wherever Gandalf's running through the forest with a hood over his head. And they're like, oh no, it's Saruman. The obvious implication, I assume, being that
he's dressed in white.
Ergo, but Saruman wears red. He looks like Santa Claus.
Maybe he'd already made the switch over at that point.
Well, maybe. And Saruman of many colors in the book, I think it's basically white, just like iridescent.
Well, because
it's
him like overreaching his grasp and being like, I'm not content being white anymore. I'm going for fucking everything here.
Okay. So it's like supposed to be like a subtle thing.
Right.
Either way, he should at least be wearing like Joseph's Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat in this movie.
Which would be fun.
Do you think that was the first clue when Gandalf shows up like, I don't think this is going to go that well. He's just showing up and Saruman's in this rainbow robe.
This guy has two hands full of coke nails. And a weird lizard voice.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, he's so good. His goofy, goofy voice.
Not very, yeah, he's not hiding.
It's not, no, because you think about also how, like, Christopher Lee, and they talk about how Saruman has, like, this crazy voice, right? It's a very persuasive voice.
Mm-hmm.
It's very recognizable.
So Christopher Lee, by the way, ace cast.
It's perfect, yeah. And then you have this guy be like, we will deal with Saruman ourselves, guys. It's just like, who the fuck are you?
Well, he has... In my mind, what would have been Grima's voice?
Yeah.
Like the very kind of like, yes, master.
Yeah, it's
kind
a
of
simpering sort of like easy
voice.
Yeah.
Or something.
But then we also just need to just spell this out for anyone listening. This movie can't even nail one of their antagonists' names down consistently.
Right.
Because I would say at least 40% of the time he's Saruman.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other 60%, he's Aruman, presumably because they're afraid people will get him mixed up.
My understanding that was
Sauron.
That was a studio mandate, to my understanding, is the studio said that it was confusing, and so they said it must be Aruman. I have no idea why it's mostly Aruman and not.
But it's just like, if the studio mandated that, why didn't they go in and be like, okay, we need to like redub this other 40%?
Yeah, I truly don't know.
It's so lazy.
Like, yeah.
It couldn't have been like that hard.
Was it, I don't know if it was like, if it was like a money thing, or they just, or they like, they put this rule down and then a week later they're like, oh, you know what? Forget it. Just fucking
maybe
do what you want.
Right.
Just like it
just
literally changes it. Like
maybe
because
it was
sentence.
Certain yeah. people and they were like, well, they fucking, we lost them. Like they already did their part. They're not coming
right.
back. Like they flew back to wherever they're from. And they just couldn't get the voice actors back to redub those lines.
We can't get John Hurt back to to re-record half of his lines.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, it's very, very weird how they completely flub something that I think would be an easy kind of like right down the middle.
It's just
deal.
Like, you know, that's just like, you know, that's filmmaking 101 right there. Like, you
keep
know.
Your characters' names consistent.
Yeah.
And if you're going to change it, make sure you're going back and changing the whole thing.
I bet it was a messy script supervisor that just, like, gave out old like, old dailies to, like, not old dailies, like, old, what are those things called? Like,
Wait,
the,
if,
sides.
Yeah, old sides.
Yeah.
Would you believe it if Ralph Bakshi was also, like, doubling a script supervisor? He was like, I don't need anyone else. My vision is singular.
Yeah.
We've kind of peppered in some comments about this as we've talked about other things, but let's really just drop the axe on the animation in this movie, because I feel like that's where a great deal of this movie's problems lie.
I feel like calling this movie the animated Lord of the Rings is doing it a lot of favors in suggesting that it is animated, when in fact...
At least entirely animated.
Yeah.
And it just gets worse as it goes on, like, throughout
yeah.
the movie.
It really,
it's more static.
Which is weird, because, like, I know that filmmaking is not linear, but it really feels like they used up all their money in the first hour of this movie, and then we're like, oh!
I mean, maybe they, like, actually did sort of make this
oh my God,
in a linear
they...
fashion, which is...
I guess.
It's uncommon, but the way they
I mean,
were doing
it, was,
it
like,
they could have,
that's
because
true.
It was all within a studio.
And it was already
so.
Filmed, so maybe they had already edited the live-action stuff into
yeah.
the movie they wanted, and then
yeah.
they literally just did do the first half, and were like, oh, no more money.
Yeah.
Or no more time. Like, we have a release date, and we have to put it out. We have to get it out there
I don't
right
know
now.
What
it
it's...
was in production for several years,
yeah.
and it
but
could
I mean,
just
like,
be,
you
like...
You still had weird mixtures even in the Shire when, like, they're going
you do.
The
right.
You do?
It's weird
but,
from the beginning. It
but,
just gets weirder.
Yeah.
But they start using that. We should lay out here. As Brendan mentioned earlier, this movie is mainly rotoscoped. But, which, as Brendan,
so,
I think, also
yeah, okay,
said,
yeah,
is,
so just, again, real quick, rotoscoping is to film people live action,
right.
doing the motions of what you want your characters to do, then you will take this and either use it as a guideline, or you will effectively trace over it and use that as your own animation.
Which was sort of done in that, what was that movie, Waking Life?
Yeah, it's done in that, it's done in Scanner Darkly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it, I mean, it's done
and,
in, a, Don Bluth uses it all the time, Disney uses
yeah, it's an
live
old
action,
technique,
yeah, Disney uses
it's...
live action footage as, like, a reference, but they don't generally use it as, like, a tracing method.
Right.
Yeah.
So, like, it's not uncommon for animators to do
that. Especially not for that time. I feel like that was a technique of the time, was it not?
Yeah, well, and I think it's also, like, when you actually had to have people hand-draw every cell.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm sure
it
saves money.
It saved money and time.
Yeah.
So it made sense. And honestly, the rotoscoping is not the problem with this.
The
it's...
problem is the solarizing technique
yeah.
that we see that becomes, I think, I would argue maybe around the midway point is when almost everything becomes solarized.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, then you have footage that is just the live-action footage, and it's tinted slightly so that it looks kind of animated, but
well, it's, like, printed out, like, on, like, essentially a photocopy
right.
or something, like...
Right.
Really,
yeah,
and it's a Photoshop filter.
Yeah, yeah, it does look like just, like, a Photoshop filter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and it's so jarring because there's many, many, many frames in which there'll be, like, an... Like, two animated, fully or rotoscoped, I suppose, but animated-looking hobbits standing next to, like, five solarized orcs. And
yeah.
it's, like,
yeah.
it's hard. It's hard on the eyes,
yeah.
this movie.
And, like, it because it's just sort of, like, you know, just they're just made of toner and not actual, like, you know, drawings, like... They all just sort of, like, blend together into a black blob.
Yeah,
and then, like,
so
that's
many
why,
of the times
like,
the ring
the
race are just, like,
and
a
the
mass.
Orcs, like, look exactly the same. I guess, like, they're carrying different weapons, but it's just, like, here's a sort of, like, photocopied thing with red eyes.
Although, if someone were to ask me what is the most successful use of the solarization in this movie, I would say it's on the ring race.
I would as well.
Yeah.
I thought that was actually used to
well,
pretty good
I do, except then when they're chasing them to the Rivendell Ford, they are just like a black mass for
yes.
so much of that. It works really good in Weathertop, I think,
mm-hmm.
where the ring race, they approach like very slowly and they're making sort of like weird like noises.
And they're
and
sort
they're,
of ghostly.
Yeah, and they're vaguely transparent. Yeah, and they
yeah.
so they kind of move like awkwardly into the frame. And I think it's a really neat look at that one point.
I also think the ring wraiths looked pretty good in earlier when that one Ringwraith is kind of like sniffing around for them around that tree in the Shire, I think I commented at the time that both the Wraith in its cloak and the horse almost just look like void in this like otherwise pretty colorful area. And I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. Didn't hold on to that, though, because they got rid of that right quick.
They have a nicely inhuman look in the beginning that works kind of well, and that just falls apart when they become just, you know, voids.
Blobs. Green blobs.
Yeah.
There are parts of the movie that look like 70% what Who Framed Roger Rabbit is, because it's the extent that, like, a fucking goofy cartoon Aragorn is standing in a battlefield with, like...
a live person.
Humans. With, like, real people, like, in
humans, but they look so, like, nightmarishly distorted.
Yeah.
And sometimes, like, just, like, their hair is moving and everything else is static. Or there's, like, something moving in the background, but then there's, like, five in front that are just standing there. And...
I mean, the last 30 minutes used a lot of, like, a frame that would be, like, 60% static, and then there would be, like, some movement going on. That was hard, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, toward the end, it's almost entirely solarized. Like, Aragorn and, you know, Gandalf will be, like, animated, but everyone else is just a real person just riding on a horse or standing there. And my understanding is that Ralph Bakshi is a huge fan of rotoscoping for whatever reason, and he thinks that it's helpful in saving time and money, and it's helpful for doing something like a battle sequence. And I kind of get that. I get that, especially at that time, it must have been very difficult to draw a large-scale battle sequence just using, you know, your brain and your hands, because that's going to be a fucking mess. But, contrary-wise, it helps if you draw over it.
Well, because the difference is so jarring and so distracting, and it's so hard in the eyes that there are many points, especially in that last sequence, that I just didn't want to look at the movie anymore.
No, it's an ugly fucking movie also, it must be said.
It's just like, the color scheme is terrible, it's so red and so brown.
Yeah, it's very muddy.
At times, the pops of green were sometimes welcome, but then that was another weird choice, where... the Ringwraiths, when they take their cloaks off, are tinted green, but then so are the orcs until the end when they're tinted red.
You might, it's like, in another world, you can almost see there being an excuse for, like, oh, all the battle sequences are red, all the sequences in Rivendell are green, like, blah, like, you know, like, how they do, like, in old black and white movies, where they would tint, like, indoor scenes, like, yellow, and they would tint, like, nighttime scenes purple, blah, blah, blah. Like, in a weird world, I could kind of see that being an artistic choice, but here it's just,
like, there's no rhyme or reason to it at all.
It just, and even if there was, it just serves to muddy it, because it's all done so poorly.
Yeah. I've said all and I just care like, to say about how this movie looks.
Yeah, and just, like, the way the characters are designed is often ugly, and costuming makes no sense.
Well, it's terrible. Boromir's a Viking. Aragorn never wears any pants.
He's like 50.
Gimli has a flower sack on his head.
Yeah, Théoden goes into battle without pants, which we've all wanted to do from time to time. I get it.
How many
not
battles?
In battle.
It's chafing.
Yeah, I know, like he's riding fucking horseback without pants on. That's gonna hurt. Théoden!
Gimli, as a side point, as the animation, is like a non-entity in this movie.
Yeah. Like he's there, but.
Legolas is only like slightly less because he shows up earlier, I think. Yeah.
It's also clear that they just. I mean, Gimli is maybe a little shorter.
Yeah, he's almost normal size.
Than Aragorn,
because it was a person. Just a person.
Right. But like, and the hobbits were like little people, but for whatever reason, Gimli was just a slightly shorter guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not like noticeably. Like, I don't look at him and think dwarf. I just think, oh, that guy's slightly shorter than whoever was playing Aragorn.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a hideous, hideous look. And a lazy one, too. It does not speak of artistic direction or vision. I think the style has no unity to it at all.
No, the Balrog's fucking goofy.
Yeah.
Very goofy.
It looks very much like a seventh grader who, like, just discovered, like,
paper
black magic or something, like, decided to draw on his notebook one day, and, like, everyone makes really ugly facial expressions for no reason.
Oh, yeah.
Sam looks like a potato. Like, there's so many things that are just wrong.
I was gonna say, the faces seem, and their expressions seem to just ooze. Like, you know what I mean? They don't form, they just sort of, like, it's almost like watching gelatin move.
I've read Bakshi saying about rotoscoping is that he likes it because it can bring, like, the subtleties of live-action to animation, but it feels like all the people doing the live-action stuff were, like, high school actors.
Yeah.
Because they all have a tendency to go big with their gestures. They, like you know, whether they're scared, they wave their hands around and, like, you know, they're, like, clamoring and just, like, no one does anything subtle in this movie.
Yeah, that was the direction.
I'm sure, I'm not like, it could have been, but it's just so bizarre that he would be like, finally, we can capture the subtleties of a live-action.
But now do this!
Yes, and then you have Gandalf, like, spinning around and waving his arms around himself.
Hobbits, clap a lot.
Yes, hobbits, shuffle your feet, look awkward. Yes. Yeah. Oh, it's so fucking goofy.
It's very goofy, and there was also, there was a point that I realized in this boring battle scene in Moria. All the battle scenes in this movie are boring. All the scenes are boring in general, but there's a scene in which there's sort of like a wide-ish shot of kind of like there's orcs on this side, and then the fellowship's on this side, and you see Legolas loosing arrows at them. And, like, one frame, his bow is, like, fancy and has these curlicues.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then there's that shot that is in between a sandwich, two cutaway shots of him with, like, a prop bow.
Yeah.
That's, like,
yeah.
flat on the ends and yeah. smaller. It's... Does anyone else have anything they want to say about the animation?
Yeah, about the animation, no.
You had something else you wanted to say in general?
Looking to score.
Please!
It's terrible. The score is garbage. It's, like, I feel like if I was being generous, I would say it would be fine for, like... I don't know, a 70s or 80s animated movie. Like,
it's very forgettable.
Fine. But yeah, but like when you fucking look at like what Howard Shore did for the Lord of the Rings trilogy, like that's like one of the most ambitious undertakings, I think, in terms of scoring a movie and I don't even know how long. Like he spent years doing that. There were so many fucking themes and motifs in that movie. Like you can identify where you are instantly because you hear the music.
Yeah.
Characters will have their own themes. Themes will be developed throughout three movies. This is just like there is a main theme and that's about it.
Well,
and one really bad song.
Yeah.
All blaring trumpets.
Yeah, it's just, it's so, there's like no thought, yeah, there's no thought in this.
It's either that or just there's like strings that sort of just bleed together into mush, so it's just sort of like, it's so forgettable and I'm not paying attention and unexciting.
Yeah.
It's like if orchestra was like jazz, like if like, yeah, like symphony was like jazz, where it's just like an orchestra going at it with just like orc hits and just like,
I'm just curious real quick, is there anything good anyone has to say about this movie before we
go on?
I'm just curious. Okay,
I think this movie
no,
because I feel like we said a few things that are good and not a whole lot else, but I'm just curious if there's anything unspoken.
I'm gonna put this out there, I think this is the biggest failure of a movie we've covered for this podcast.
I think it's certainly the dullest.
I think this movie fails on every level.
I'm just like looking
its achievements are few and fleeting.
Yeah, there are a few moments that work well. I think there are moments that sort of influence Peter Jackson, like the proud feet shot and the hobbits under the tree root.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also heard that it's just because there was a concept artist who worked on the Peter Jackson movies who was a fan of the Bakshi movies or something. So like,
well, there was also like a calendar that came out in the '80s
right,
that had some of those shots
right,
too.
Right.
Oh.
So it's possible that he was not directly influenced by this movie.
It was sort of like a continuing influence throughout other Tolkien art.
Yeah.
That
and
bled down into Peter Jackson.
I guess like it's just worth, I guess it's also just worth me saying like, if it had not been for this movie, I wouldn't have that fucking comic. And the fucking
so,
comic,
like thank you.
like, literally informed me about the basics of Lord of the Rings. And, like, yeah, a lot of that was inaccurate, but a lot of it was pretty, like, it gave me, like, the gist. Like, I was able to fake being a Lord of the Rings person.
You know what, though? What
for a while.
What an amazing starting point for someone to
like,
into that mythos.
Like, because somehow, all growing up, I knew that there were, like, nine people in the Fellowship, and, like, Legolas was an elf, and Gimli was a dwarf, and, like, somehow I knew all of that, and I have never read the book. And it must have been from that photo novel. And just asking my parents, like, this is how it is, right? Like.
So if we're all set there, who would like to give us our first fix?
Mine's really quick.
Go for it. Lead us off, Lee.
I think I was given, like,
off.
So we were given, like, a sort of specific task. Like, because you wanted...
Oh, yeah, we should talk about that.
Specific constraints.
Yeah, you were given... Yeah, you gave us specific restraints.
Well, because we're...
Because otherwise it's,
but,
like...
But I think it's appropriate.
Adapt Lord of the Rings.
Right,
yeah.
Because I think it's appropriate because we're given a pretty... different set of circumstances in which this movie exists.
Right. So effectively, what we're starting out with here is the idea that you are in Ralph Bakshi's shoes and you are given two movies, or if you feel like protesting and saying, no, I can do it in one, that's okay too. But you can't just be like, oh no, we'd do three movies and we'd just do the books, that's fine. So you have effectively the same limitations that Ralph Bakshi would have had in the 70s.
Yeah.
So
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about how to do this in two movies, and what I ended up coming up with is the first movie is Frodo's journey. Like, but so both movies have both plot lines. I think you have Frodo's journey of getting the ring to Mordor, and you have Aragorn's journey of uniting the armies of men, and like taking them to Sauron's gate or whatever the fuck it's called.
Mordor.
So good at the Lord of the Rings.
Isengard?
Lore.
Or?
No,
Isengard's where Saruman is.
Mordor.
Asgiliath?
Yeah.
About the gate.
The Black, isn't it called the Black Gate?
Black Gate, yeah.
But, like, it basically him, like, uniting all of the people to get to where, like, Mordor to, like, you know, be that battle and distraction so that Frodo can, like, actually destroy the ring.
Yeah.
And also Aragorn's personal quest of, like, reclaiming his throne, ultimately.
Which is compelling stuff.
Yeah. And you need to, if you're going to divide up the plot lines, you need to pick one person who's the protagonist of each, and Aragorn is the obvious choice for, like, everyone else in the Fellowship.
So then kind of do check-ins with each one.
Yeah, so, like, the first one is, like, a 70-30 with Frodo, and the second one is a 70-30 with Aragorn.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one is, like, mostly about Frodo leaving the Shire, and it still would end, I think, with Frodo and Sam sort of separating. And maybe you could, I think there are bits that you could chronologically chop out, where, like, you do cover more of Aragorn's stuff in the first movie that maybe that technically happens afterward. I think you also give Aragorn, if you're going to do it in two movies, like, one at most two kingdoms to unite and not, like, fucking three. Like, they go to Rohan, they, like, there's the Battle of Isengard, and there's, like, the Helm's Deep, like, there's Helm's Deep, and then there's, like, Minas Tirith. I don't care. There's, like, a lot of, like, places he goes to and, like, accomplishes a thing at each one and sort of gains an ally at each one. And I think that you just have to, like, pick a couple. And just show that Aragorn is, like, uniting people mm-hmm. under a cause. And the second one would focus, like, mostly on Aragorn doing that. And because, like, after Frodo and Sam leave the Fellowship, it's every time you go back to them, it's just like, yep, there they are. Like,
still walking.
Still trucking. Like, then we don't need them at that point. At that point on, we can just, like, kind of get a few check-ins with, like, them. Mm-hmm. Because it's pretty obvious, the arc at that point, it's pretty obvious, like, every time we see them, they're going to be a bit closer to Mordor, and Gollum is going to be, like, a bit more on the edge of betraying them. So I think you only need a few check-ins with them, and the second movie just focuses more on, I don't know which two. I do kind of like Rohan. I think Rohan shows, like, Rohan is where Aragorn shows, like, leadership promise at first, and I do like the fact that there's a bit that is not solved through warfare in Rohan, that it's solved more through, like, you've got this slimy sleazeball. And unfortunately, like, I don't want to tell Tolkien how to do his job, but, like, I would have made it, I feel like if it was me writing a sort of, like, there's a sneaky advisor, I wouldn't call him, like, Grime a Worm.
Which is a dead giveaway.
Yeah,
though.
And yeah. Have him be, like, so evil. I would have had him have, like, a normal name. Evil. Yeah, I'd have him have, like, a normal name and just sound like he's being, like, kind of a wimpy advisor that's like, no, we shouldn't be in this war. But, like, outside the first second,
creamy,
like...
Creamy McSmile face.
Yeah, like, everyone, they get to Rohan, and everyone's like, well, here's your fucking problem.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Hired a guy named Wormtongue, yeah. Like...
And everyone... And then you have anyone has to be like, guys, I think there's something wrong.
I don't want to, like, be the first one to say it, but...
God, like, you think? Anyway, that is sort of my rough fix with not very little detail involved.
If I could go next, because I just... Your fix is... remarkably similar to mine.
I'm glad I went first, because now it sounds like it was my idea.
No, exactly. Very, very, very similar to yours. I think... Because it was tough. I was trying to figure out, because I think I would also try to keep it in two movies. I think I'm cutting most of the Rohan stuff, except for I'm going to expand out the whole Grima Worm tongue hissing in what's-his-nuts's ear. But I think I would want to call out, because one of my things was, like, I need someone in this world to acknowledge how, like, obvious it is that a guy named Grima Wormtongue is not giving you the straight dope. My thing about was, like, where I would cut it, kind of between the first movie and the second, because my thought was, I think it would be kind of exciting to leave the first one on kind of a cliffhangery note of, like, we know Helm's Deep is going to happen. Sam and Frodo have already kind of gone off and done their own thing and are, like, trudging through the gross swamps on the way to Mount Doom. Because I think it would be great to start off the second movie with Helm's Deep, and that would kind of be, like, a really good catalyst, kind of showing you, okay, like, you know, in the first movie this was more about the journey, but the second movie is just going to be, like, Battle City. Because we have that, we have the Battle of Isengard, and then we have the Final Siege. And I actually think that would be a really good way to anchor all three acts of that second movie, that we have Helm's Deep, Isengard, and then... the Final Siege of Mordor. Otherwise, I pretty much have the same fix as you do, which is the first movie is going to be very Frodo-centric with, we get, like, set up for Aragorn's arc. I was not completely settled in how I would show him uniting people, but that was sort of the main thrust of it. I kind of dickered with the idea of trying to maybe fudge it so that these leaders of these kingdoms were potentially all in one place, and that part of showing how Aragorn would unite them would be to actually make them stop fighting first, because maybe I could show, like, hey, not only are you guys stronger together, but also stronger when you cooperate and aren't at each other's backs. But yeah, and then the second movie would just be Aragorn's arc of, like, waging beautiful bloody warfare to reclaim the throne of man.
I mean, we didn't talk about this at all. I didn't tell you anything about
it. I know.
Yeah.
Yeah,
neither
no.
did I. Neither
yeah.
did I to you. We tapped into the same place in the, what is
yeah.
that? The creative unconsciousness?
Yep.
I mean, I guess I kind of did too. Because, I mean, if you need to adapt this in a very short way, the only way to do it is to just do a complete blitzkrieg on the plot and
yeah.
change everything. But I cut it even more, because I basically just cut out, like, half the Fellowship and was, like, really focusing more on, like, Frodo and Sam and Gollum and, like, that storyline. Keeping Gandalf, Saruman, and Aragorn, but I cut out Aragorn being king? And I kind of put him more in the Boromir role, because I like the part where Boromir, like, is tempted. But, like, you know, I just like the whole, like, idea of showing the fallibility of man or something like that. So I just sort of had, like, Aragorn being in that Boromir role and then splitting off because he's, like, ashamed of himself. And then he, like, redeems himself by sort of rallying everyone else afterwards.
Mm.
And, like, I don't know. Like, I cut down Gandalf's, too, because, like, really, why does he need to become Gandalf the White in the story?
Because, like, I don't know.
I don't,
yeah, in a condensed version, there's not really a good
reason. Like, there's
reason
not
for
really
it.
A good reason for it. And as much as I like the Balrog scene, I kind of just took that out. And I was trying to figure out a way to just put the Balrog in somewhere else because he is kind of a badass.
Do you think that was also C.S. Lewis' influence? Just, like, quick sidebar, where it's sort of like the Return of Aslan.
I mean, that's kind of,
I mean, that,
like,
that's
kind
just,
of common.
That's
trope.
Just, like, a Jesus
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
Like, that goes way back, so I don't even know. But, yeah, like, I cut out, I mean, the elves are there, and, like, the Council of Elrond happens, and maybe the other characters from the Fellowship are there, but they don't need to go along if you're condensing it more.
Did any of you guys ever see the Rankin-Bass Return of the King?
No.
Mm-hmm. Because that cuts out Gimli and Legolas entirely.
Is
it's
it
sort
really?
Of really interesting to see that, yeah.
Interesting.
I've seen The Hobbit. I don't think I've seen Lord of the Rings.
Return
of the King.
Yeah, don't bother.
I mean, I'm kind of curious now.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's worth it. If you ever saw an orc and was like, oh, I wish this guy would sing more, then you should probably see Return of the King.
In my
they
head,
sing
that
a
sounds
fucking lot in this movie, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, they say everyone sings a lot in the books.
Dancers.
Tolkien loved to write songs.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
And, Brendan.
Hi.
Take us home with a Brendan Drishler treatment.
Good day to you. So, as I said earlier, I had read most of the John Borman script that he had done for Lord of the Rings, condensing it into one movie. And my takeaway from it was that it was interesting and made a lot of interesting choices. It made a lot of dumb choices, but it also made a lot of interesting ones. And it seemed more impressive to me than the Bakshi one. So I know that in another universe, I could be sitting here being like, guys, I can't fucking believe you watched the John Borman Lord of the Rings and what a fucking shit show this was. But there are some things from it that I took away in using and basically stealing wholesale from it for my fixes. So what I would do is I would cut the Bilbo, everything at the beginning would cut. It would effectively open in the scene where Frodo is sitting in the chair sleeping, then Gandalf shows up and is like, hey, I'm back, bitches. So I would cut the entire history of the ring sequence. That would be an info dump given to Frodo from Gandalf once he shows up to explain the ring again. Gollum is following them pretty much from the beginning. He's always going to be sort of lurking off in the sides because he sort of suspects something is there. Because I think in this movie, it makes him a really weird-ass threat where he just sort of pops up toward the end and is like, I'm here now and
he's
I'm going to kill you.
Sudden.
Yeah.
That's true.
This thing I stole completely from the Borman script where Aragorn meets the hobbits on the road. After the first wraith shows up and leaves, Aragorn fakes them out sort of by showing up on a horse also wearing a cloak. And they're kind of like, oh shit, is it a ring wraith again? And it turns out just Aragorn. So you cut the entire sequence at Bree because he just shows up and heads them off there effectively. The Lothlorien sequence is going to be combined with Rivendell. So it will all happen in the scene where the council is taking place.
Oh,
Galadriel's there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that's clever.
It just felt like
it's
a good
way.
It's
just they're both elves.
Right.
They're not that different.
Right. There's a before and after, and it's fine
how
if you're doing
you.
Three movies. All
you.
Elves are the same, guys.
How
that's
dare
the
you.
Well, so then just a quick question for the two
yeah.
of you, then, since you guys both did the similar. I'm just curious to
yeah.
know the answer to this question. Then do you keep both Galadriel and Elrond, or do you make them into one character?
I think they serve different purposes. Elrond is more of like, let's, like, you know, sit down and talk about what we're going to do. And Galadriel's more like, I'm going to show you what's going to happen.
Right. I have Galadriel in there to sort of spur Frodo on and be like, this is what could happen. This is why you need to do what you need to do. My other thought was also, I did think about cutting Galadriel, but then I was like, there's fucking no women in this story at a certain point. Yeah. So, like, Galadriel has to be in there just so that there is a woman. Because I'd also said, like, maybe you could cut Arwen and Yowen, but I was like, no, you can't, because there's no fucking women in this story. So during the council, they are also charged not just with going to Mordor, but with rallying forces. So they always intend to stop at Edoras and Rohan. Like, that was always part of their mission. Merry and Pippin get split up from the group whenever they're at that sort of impasse and Boromir gets attacked by orcs. They don't get captured, and they're found by Treebeard. The last we see of Frodo and Sam is the first time they see Mount Doom, as Gollum finally sort of, like, reveals himself openly and is like, I've been following you, wah, and attacks them. Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli go to Edoras to continue their task, and that's when they meet Gandalf there. He shows up, like, it's like the last reveal of the movie is where they go inside and see Theoden, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, fucking Gandalf's here. How the hell did this happen? And it's like, ta-da! Cut to end credits. I would cut the Battle of the Hornburg entirely, and I would cut Yomer and Faramir. And effectively, the second movie would just be most of Return of the King with the ambush on Isengard and Shelob wedged into it. Because when you're condensing three things into two, you have to just sort of look at what doesn't work. And honestly, for these three movies, if you're going to shove them in, a lot of the Two Towers is going to end up getting cut. Because the Two Towers is the connective tissue.
It is, like, the weakest narratively.
Yeah, it links one to three. One has a whole lot of info, and three has a whole lot of conclusion. And two is just, like, how are we getting from here to here?
Right.
But the fact is, if you just end with the three of them meeting Gandalf and Theoden and Edoras, then they're like, okay, now let's fucking go. Let's start heading to Gondor and get our shit together. It's fine. You miss, obviously, characterization. You miss battle sequences. But at the end of the day, the story gets where it needs to go.
Well, and if you're compressing three very long books into two movies, you're going to have to make some hard cuts.
Right.
And that's what's going to happen.
Apparently, I had also read somewhere that when, I don't know if it was the Borman adaptation or another one, another, like, adaptation that was being done, Tolkien had, like, given notes to one of the screenwriters suggesting things to cut, and one of the things he suggested with cutting was the Battle of the Hornburg, because he felt that narratively it's not going to add a whole lot to this if you're condensing it to one. And frankly, like, he's not wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I feel like this movie is very thoroughly fixed, because there was a lot to be scrubbed up with it.
Yeah. Does anyone want to recommend this movie?
No.
There's literally no reason to watch this, because there is nothing that is done here that is not done better somewhere else.
Yeah. Don't waste your time.
Do not waste your time. This is not even so bad it's good. It's so bad it's so fucking boring.
It's just
boring.
So long, too, right? Yeah. Like, you could watch the theatrical cut of The Fellowship of the Rings in, like, almost the same amount of time that it takes you to watch this.
Now, I mean, it's more than now more than ever, Peter Jackson exists. There is no fucking reason.
And also, and also Ralph Bakshi has movies that are more interesting. Like,
even when they're not good, they're still interesting.
Like, you know, they're at least, there's more of a reason to watch them, because
there's less of a narrative issue. There's less of a...
Even if there are narrative issues, it's still, it's something unique, and it's not just, like, boring.
It's at least doing something that's holding your attention in some way. Whereas, after this, I felt like I needed to take a nap. Like, this movie was putting
me to sleep. Oh, it's so fucking slow. At the end, like, it's honest to God, after the Fellowship splits up, it's a fucking interminable slog to the end of this movie.
And, you know what? Goddamn this movie for how many times there's a battle scene, and it's the most listless. Everyone's standing still.
Everyone's staring. Occasionally people will run at each other.
They might shoot an arrow or something. And it's horrible. It's just, it's such a slog.
I've never thought that someone, like, could take a Tolkien battle and make it more dry and less fun. But my God, Ralph Bakshi found a way to do it.
He really,
so,
really did.
So TLDR, no.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Under no circumstance did you see this.
The only reason why everyone in this room watched it was to talk about it on this podcast and then tell you not to watch it.
Read the photo novel if you want. Good idea of what it was like.
Well, and honestly, unless you have your own bad movie podcast, maybe consider watching this, but otherwise don't.
Honestly, quit
giving ideas, first of all.
Yeah, for one thing, yes, but also it's just like, it's not even, like, interesting to talk about, because nothing happens.
Whoa. We gotta make some money off this podcast.
Yeah, slow your roll.
Everyone has gotten to this point that, you know.
Before we reveal that this is all a scam.
Oh, man. All right. Well, as always, you can find us on Facebook. Brendan, what's that link?
It's called facebook.com/whywatchpodcast.
You can find our dormant account on Twitter.
No, you can't. And you can also go to our website at www.dratpack.com.
All right, should we buy this one out, guys?
Biomir.
Oh, I like that.
No, I don't. I regret instantly saying it.
Should we do like the better Lord of the Rings theme and go like bye, 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 bye,